From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. Reverend Welton Gaddy, our host, is out this week. I'm Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting this week from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. And if you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And so here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio. It was inspiring to see many groups led by women speak out boldly in support of the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford and other Kavanaugh accusers. No, this does not equate to a denial of due process, despite what the loudest of Republican voices have been shouting. Rather, it means soberly evaluating allegations, despite the fact that they may challenge the predestined ascendancy of powerful men and their agendas. Among other acts of support for the right of Dr. Ford to be heard was a small group of Massachusetts high school students walking out of class. Male students. We'll hear more from activist Jack Torres, class of 2020.
Dangerous movement, undetected by many, but real. Is now challenging and eroding a great tradition of religious freedom. There can be no doubt. It's no little matter. It must be confronted intellectually and politically and defeated.
A significant number of news stories around the world are, in one way or another, religion news stories. Events are driven by convictions and beliefs, and in turn they impact religious groups and communities, often in unpredictable ways. Secular journalists notoriously have a difficult time integrating this reality into their coverage, which is why the work of Religion News Service is so invaluable. On this week's show, you'll meet the new editor-in-chief at RNS, Bob Smetana. But first,
Faith and Action. We are a ministry right here on Capitol Hill. We minister to the elected officials throughout the Supreme Court and to anyone on the street. We serve a risen Savior. He died on the cross for us. He saved our sins. Brett Kavanaugh and his wife announced their strong faith. I want to pray for him, his family.
It's like some twisted version of diplomatic immunity. If you're the right kind of political conservative who claims the mantle of evangelical Christianity, you can do no wrong. It serves as a shield for the current president, and it feeds the uncritical devotion to Brett Kavanaugh that we saw on display this week. As a side note, this is the flip side of the rhetoric that baselessly branded Barack Obama an atheist Muslim. Dr. J. Michelson is a rabbi and an attorney who's been admitted to the Supreme Court bar, and I'm glad we can call on all of that expertise to evaluate what we saw happen this week in the Kavanaugh nomination saga. Jay, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Rabbi Jack. It's great to be here.
So what stood out for you in Thursday's Judiciary Committee hearings?
Well, you know, as we're recording this on the day after and the day on which the vote is likely to go through with Kavanaugh being approved, it's overwhelming. My overwhelming reaction is one of sadness. I think the gulf, not only between Republicans and Democrats or conservatives and liberals, but in spiritual ways of being in the world, just felt unbridgeable. You know, the notion that the more angry and bully-like Judge Kavanaugh appeared, the more appealing he was it would really give those of us who are people of faith a lot of concern and a lot of pause. It's not certain that Judge Kavanaugh will be confirmed by the Senate. Certainly, there are still a couple of wavering senators, but to see a compelling, open-hearted, and credible survivor of sexual assault talk for hours, then to see an angry, defensive, and evasive bully talk as well, and then have the latter be the one who was believed by so many people, is something I'm still wrestling with.
He didn't seem very likable, did he? Is this at least partly the sign of someone who's unused to being questioned?
I think that was a part of it. I think also, you know, it's a real question of what his strategy was. And I think, you know, Brett Kavanaugh used to run judicial confirmation for the Bush White House. And he's a political animal first and foremost. He has been for 40 years. And I should say, you know, as a legal affairs columnist for the Daily Beast, I've read thousands of these emails and the other documents that were released. Of course, there are hundreds of thousands of pages that we haven't seen. So my knowledge, if you could call it that, of Judge Kavanaugh is just based on reading a lot of his words, his opinions, seeing his actions and so on. You know, it seemed as though he was playing for an audience of one, Donald Trump, who felt that and who that wasn't strong enough and feels this is the worst possible thing for a man to show. So Kavanaugh came out swinging. I'm surprised that that was the strategy to win over Senators Collins and Murkowski, and the jury is out on that. But it seemed as though part of it was the sense of entitlement that you mentioned, and part of it was a deliberate strategy to seem as strong as possible.
He came off in many ways as angry and paranoid, and more than a little frightening sometimes. How does that play into the notion of judicial temperament?
Well, we've never had a confirmation here at process like this in a number of ways. And certainly we've never seen a nominee act like this, accuse an entire political party of some kind of conspiracy to undermine him. You know, there's never been, but nothing like this, nothing in public. It's only been private with rumors about how judges or justices are in chamber. But you really have to wonder, it's not going to matter for the confirmation. Just as we reflect on who's about to take the seat on the Supreme Court, if this angry temperament is really suited, again, it's not going to matter for the vote. But as we actually think about who's taking the seat, how many times he interrupted and joining together the allegations of assault that is really the extreme record of not taking the experiences of women in his case, in his opinion. It really is a sad day, I think, for those of us who really believe in the rule of law.
This whole process is playing out like a TV melodrama. Is this all we've got left of democracy, both in our elections and now even in the confirmation process for the highest court of the land?
Well, we knew when the Republican dominated Senate stonewalled Eric Garland, that the rules had just been thrown out the window, and we're now living in the reality that they created. I think one of the ironies of the process has been how Senator Lindsey Graham has been, you know, whining about how what happened to our civil confirmation process. And what happened was that the Republicans destroyed it in 2016. At some point, there will have to be some kind of leveling out or correction or something. But we wouldn't be having any of this if Senator Grassley weren't steamrolling this nomination. Wouldn't be steamrolling it through if there weren't a midterm election coming up for the Republicans. So I'm not quite as pessimistic as some are that this reflects the state of our democracy. First, the Republican Party is a minority party in the country. They have all three branches of government, but they only have the support of about 40% of the electorate. Right? We have a president who lost the popular vote. We have a Senate that represents the minority of the U.S. population, minority party. And I think, to some extent, the high-pressure situation of this confirmation battle is an effect of this very unusual political.
So is it your opinion that these experiences have changed the nomination confirmation process? Or if there is a turnover in control of of Congress, do you think we'll go back to the way things were?
We won't go back to the way things were, no. This does feel a little bit like the confirmation process of Robert Bork, which did permanently, will now at least change the nature of the process. The two sides can't be constantly playing nuclear war with each other. That destroys everyone. But again, I mean, it's maybe just my bias, but the nuclear option was called that for a reason, and the Republicans pushed the button for Justice Gorsuch, nuclear option, after they went nuclear another time with Judge Garland. So we're living already after two nuclear buttons. It's certainly not the Democrats who are engaging in some theatrics and grandstanding who are going nuclear. So we're still living in the shadow of the two nuclear options that have already been exercised by the Senate.
You mentioned Judge Merrick Garland, and maybe you won't be able to answer this question, but I'll ask it anyway. As one of his former law clerks, do you know how the events of the past couple of years have impacted him?
Yeah, I'm going to take the fifth on that one.
Okay, so I'll answer it for you. I actually met Judge Garland just a couple of weeks ago and was able to share with him that when we were in high school at the same time in different high schools in the Chicago area, we debated each other. And he laughed, and I said, and my partner and I talked, and we decided we beat you. And he smiled and said, thank you for helping me learn how to lose graciously.
That's great. I also saw Judge Garland recently, but a lot of his former clerks meet up with him, and, you know, I don't talk about it.
Fair enough. Jay, can you even begin to imagine what the sitting Supreme Court justices must be thinking as they watch this confirmation process unfold?
You know, it falls back, as you know, Jack, and as you yourself practice, you know, you and I swim in two different worlds at the same time, one being the rabbinic world and spiritual world and religious, and the other being very much the political world. And often those are separate, but in moments like this, they really feel like highly overlapping. See one without the other. To me, the sense of spiritual crisis that this battle represents is profound. This, you know, when Justice Thomas went onto the bench, there were a lot of folks who felt like there was a cloud over him, and that cloud hasn't really dissipated in the intervening years. It got thinner, but it never went away. And this feels very similar. It feels like a loss to the country that Judge Kavanaugh did not step back and withdraw. And assuming he is confirmed, it's now two justices, three of these clouds hanging over them. And I cannot imagine what it's like. You know, I think with all of what happened with Justice Gorsuch, at least there were none of these kinds of, he certainly didn't explode and have temper tantrums and rage at the committee. And there weren't these kinds of allegations. Ultimately, I think all of the justices, including future Justice Kavanaugh, have a vested interest in the reputation of the Supreme Court, and they're going to get to work. And again, I could be more pessimistic here, but I think actually what unites all of the justices is desire to maintain or recreate the credibility of the court. And we need that. All of us need that now, liberals and conservatives alike, because we're up against an executive branch that has no respect for the rule of law. So even as difficult as it's been to kind of swallow our discontent around Gorsuch, maybe more so for Justice Kavanaugh, my argument is that those of us who care about America need to do something, because as flawed as the Supreme Court is, better than the only.
So your prediction is that the Supreme Court will be a force for restabilizing America, or is it something else?
Yeah, that is the prediction. Not, you know, it may be a weakened force or a damaged force. We'll overturn Roe versus Wade, and there will be a moment of national crisis. But again, where the sticks have moved, and we're dealing with an authoritarian administration. and we're dealing with the Russia investigation, would really in some way go up. The stakes are extremely high. I think the court's already failed once in upholding the travel ban and taking at face value the obviously false pretext for the travel ban offered by the Trump. That was a major test, and I think the court failed. And we'll see what it does the next time.
Well, we'll have you back to talk about that when the time comes. Dr. J. Michelson is a rabbi, an author, an activist, and an attorney who writes prolifically for The Daily Beast, The Forward, and other leading publications. Jay is an affiliated assistant professor at Chicago Theological Seminary, and his books range from the essential God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, to The Gate of Tears, Sadness, and the Spiritual Path. Jay, thanks again for taking the time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Jack. My pleasure.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear from a high schooler who's trying to rally student support for abuse survivors like Christine Blasey Ford. And up next, the new editor-in-chief at Religion News Service, Bob Smetana. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Rabbi Jack Moline, filling in for Welton, who's out this week. Around here, we have relied on the non-denominational, non-partisan coverage of Religion News, which is most news, really, from Religion News Service for as long as this show has been on the air. Last month, Bob Smetana accepted the position of RNS Editor-in-Chief, and so we think it's important for all of us to get to know each other. And so I'm happy to welcome him to State of Belief Radio. Bob, thanks for being with us.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Would you do our listeners the favor of introducing yourself with a quick overview of your professional journey that brought you here?
Sure. I have a journey. I'm kind of a second career religion journalist. I was a religion major in college, wrote for my college newspaper. And then I decided, like many young people do, to kind of go out and try and save the world and make it a better place. So I worked for Habitat for Humanity. I worked for several nonprofits and found out that the world needs some saving, but I wasn't very good at it. But what I was good at is writing about what people were doing. So I went back to grad school in my 30s, got a job as a religion, first a magazine editor, and then did some book work, and then 2007, I became the religion writer for the Tennessean here in Nashville, where I live. Was there for 6 years and did some more magazine work, and then I came to RNS. And I've had a long involvement with RNS. I first did my first freelance piece for them in 2001. So I've had bylines from them all over the country. So it's a I'm a kind of a ravenous religion news consumer, and I'm interested in every part of religious life in America. So it's the perfect job for me.
So you and I both know that writing for an organization is different than leading that organization. What made you want to take on the challenge of leading the Religion News Service?
That's a great question. So it's because they're looking for a leader, so that's one part, and because it's the perfect time to be in RNS. So, you know, the American religious landscape is being rewritten, reinvented right in front of our eyes. Country, you know, when I was born, I'm 53. When I was born, most Americans were white and Christian. Most younger Americans are not white or Christian, right? We're becoming, so we've seen enormous racial, ethnic, political, social, religious change in the last 50 years. So the future of America is going to look very different than the past. And RNS is in the perfect spot to cover the religion angle of that, right? What is the religious landscape going to look like in the future? What stories aren't being covered? So it's the best place to do that. And I felt like the other thing is RNS really changed my life. You know, I was an unknown magazine editor. And they took a chance on me, let me do all kinds of great stories, got me got me the career that I have, and so I want to do that for other folks.
So a lot of religion journalism is done at the local level. What's the importance of a national outlet like Religion News Service?
So that's a great question. So there's two parts. One is that local folks don't always know the big picture trends that are shaping what's happening in their community. So they might see their community, they may not know what's happening in other communities. So it's a way to let local folks have a bigger picture. And I think we know the big picture, but it's great to have local examples of that. So the National News Service can actually report those local stories, stitch a bunch of them together and say, here's this national trend and here's how it's playing out.
Bob, I know that you know that journalism is under attack from a lot of quarters these days to be responsible and even-handed. How does that play out in covering religion?
Well, it means that we treat everyone the same. And it goes back to basic journalism. If you're a good journalist, you quote people accurately, you treat them with common courtesy, you ask hard questions, and you quote them accurately. And you don't cover your friends better than the people you disagree with. So you cover it the same way any other journalism is. Now, it's harder because we don't have the, say, access to public documents. If you're covering City Hall you want to see public documents, you know, when I was at the Tennessean, if I wanted to see something from the governor's office, I called the governor's office and they had to give it to me. You know, if I call the Pope or the head of the Southern Baptist Convention, or the head of Reformed Judaism, or a local congregation leader, they don't have to give me anything. So there's a lot of watchdog work, but it's more complicated. It's very hard. You just have to play it down the street. We report it straight. We talk to people, report what they say, and be as even-handed as we can. That means we publish op-eds of differing viewpoints.
Can you give me an example of where the mainstream media misses the religion angle of important news stories?
Oh, boy. I think one they miss is, I spent a lot of time covering the evangelical world. So the evangelical world is a very interesting world. It's a very diverse world. What we see, so when we talk about, for example, evangelicals, we don't necessarily think about African-American evangelicals or Hispanic evangelicals. Or charismatic evangelicals. We don't think about any of those kind of things. And we don't think of the different viewpoints in those kind of groups. The hard part about religion is if it's not your religion, it sounds weird. You know, if you know religious beliefs, every religious belief sounds odd to outsiders. So it's easy to not listen to folks and understand what they mean and what the words they mean say. So that's a one story I think is being missing is the growth of Pentecostal and prosperity gospel Christianity, right? We see a ton of it. We see the televangelist stuff, the scandal stuff, but we don't see how powerful that is in local communities.
Or even on a national level, I would expect. You know, this current administration and the government in general seems particularly receptive to those kinds of influences you're talking about. Is there a way to cover that influence without immediately seeming partisan?
Yeah, that's very interesting. So we did a story. I'll tell you about a story we did this week. We did a story. There is a movie out called The Trump Prophecy, which is coming out, which is about folks who think that Trump was a ordained figure, that they foresee that God planned this out for Trump to be the president. So we reported on the movie. We reported on the and it worked, and some students from Liberty University were involved, and then they didn't like the message in the movie, so they actually protested the movie that which they worked on. But we played it straight and said, okay, this is what folks believe. This is what they say. This is what folks who study this movement say about them and why it contrasts with other kinds of prophecy and we just played it straight. I think that's the way to cover these things. And then I think we also cover where, so we did a story earlier this year about the High Holidays calls to rabbis. There's been one for several years, and then there wasn't going to be one, or there wasn't much planning about it. And there was, if you remember, there was a big event for evangelical, white evangelicals, mostly supporters of Trump, and right before the High Holidays. And then, so we had a reporter asking, you know, when's the call going to be? Is there going to be a call? And, you know, then all of a sudden there was a call. So I think our reporting got more information about how the administration was dealing with different groups. We've got some folks reporting on that now. So you just report it straight.
I appreciate your reporting on that, because actually that's how I found out about that call to rabbis. How about the challenges of covering a story that is wide-reaching and controversial, like this continuing series of revelations about abuse by Catholic clergy and the political tensions around Pope Francis and his reaction to it?
Yeah, so that is, we're spending a lot of time on that. And so there's just there's a lot of work to get it right. There's a lot of work to figure out what we can cover that someone else isn't covering. We had some folks there have been some, several dioceses have held sort of healing services so we had someone go to one in Raleigh, North Carolina, where the bishop gave his homily on his knees and ask for forgiveness. So we covered that, you know, we covered the how congregations and how religious dioceses are dealing with this. And we also had one of our reporters, Jack Jenkins, who's one of the very, very fine reporters we have. We have a great staff. But Jack and his colleague, Emily Miller, called every diocese in the U.S. to find out if they were going to open up their files to law enforcement. Had they opened their files, and sometimes they were faxing people, because some of the dioceses communicate by fax, so that we were doing the groundbreaking grunt work of finding how this is playing out on a national level and a local level, and then parsing out all the theatrics and papal drama, and competing with every other reporter trying to do this. It's a lot of work.
It is. And I want you to set aside this story, which is obviously occupying the imagination of a lot of Americans right now, and surprise me with one or two of the most important religion news stories so far this year.
Oh, boy, that is a great question. Well, I think one of them, because I've covered it, is the downfall and departure of Bill Hybels, the pastor of Willow Creek Community Church outside of Chicago,
it's one of the most influential evangelical, it's actually one of the most influential Protestant churches in America and around the world, because they have tens of thousands of church leaders from around the world who have modeled their church practices and leadership practices on Willow Creek, where it appears there was abuse of power and misconduct. And so what does that say about this whole model, which has really shaped Protestant life,
over the last 40 years? So that's one of the biggest ones. And I've covered that one, so that's why I think of it as huge.
Great. Where do you think you'll be focusing your attention between now and the end of 2018?
Well, we're going to be following the Supreme Court, obviously, and the elections, and we're going to be talking about what's going on in Catholic Church. We're really trying to get some inroads into Hispanic Catholic communities. There was a big discipleship meeting, big meeting of Hispanic Catholics in Texas on some of the programs they have at a local level that we covered, but hasn't been covered a lot. We're going to be covering the shooting of Botham Jean in Dallas, you know, a young African-American man who was a leader at his church and a song leader and, shot down in his own apartment. We're going to be covering anything else that comes up unexpected, which is probably everything.
That's the news business in general.
We're going to be, I think the big stories right now are some of the biggest stories, but I think the whole fallout from the Me Too movement is going to be a big story. It's going to continue to be, how do people make sense of this? How do people make amends for things they did in the past? Can they make amends for it? What do we do about these? How do we listen to people who have never been listened to and give them a voice?
Boy, that's an essential question for every faith tradition.
And then how do we make, how do people make amends and make things right? For right. things they did when they were young and things they did for when they're older and things they did for years. And I mean, that's the business of religion, is how do you deal with things that have gone wrong? So we'll be covering that.
All right, so here's my last question to you, Bob. Do you have plans for Religion News Service that you'd be willing to share with us on the air today?
Our plan is this, to cover this religious landscape as best we can and to grow it and to see that in 15, 20 years, we are still thriving the way we are now. So we've got a lot of plans in the work. I've been on the job for 4 weeks, so I'm just still in the figuring out everything we do and how our systems work. But we've got some really exciting things going on. I think one of the big things we're going to be doing, actually, to start off, is covering the young life of millennials in the U.S. and the religious life of millennials in the U.S. and around the world, which is going to involve a lot of people of color and a lot of people who don't get covered. So that's one of the things I'm really excited about. We're just going to cover a lot of folks who haven't been seen. The other thing, I guess this is something that really has excited me. We have been, over the last few months, expanding our international coverage. So we have a story this week, which I think is really important and really interesting, about deaf Indians. Where do they worship? Because not many congregations have sign language interpretation. And there's, you know, tens of thousands of folks who are hearing impaired in Tanzania and Africa who are saying, well, how do we worship if we can't understand what the preacher is saying, about our sacred text? Well, how do we participate? And if there's not interpretation, where do we fit in? So that's a fantastic story that doesn't get much coverage, right? There's a story about religious people trying to help child brides in Kenya. We had a story about LGBT folks worshiping in the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya. So we're getting kind of overseas views that folks, these are really important religious stories that aren't getting much attention. And they're being done by, so most of the reporting Africa is being done by African journals, which I think is fantastic.
Fascinating.
Over and reporting from there.
Just fascinating. Bob Smetana is a longtime religious journalist who is the new editor-in-chief at the invaluable Religion News Service. You'll find RNS stories syndicated across most major news platforms and online at religionnews.com. Bob, thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. I know we'll be coming back asking you for more of your time again soon, after you get past the second month of your tenure on State of Belief Radio. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, it's the youth.
I'm Rabbi Jack Moline, sitting in today for Welton Gaddy. In all the coverage of the accusations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh specifically, and of the Me Too movement more broadly, an unavoidable defense has become some version of youthful indiscretion. But you know what? For some young Americans, particularly urban, African-American Americans, one youthful indiscretion can easily lead to death in the street, or even in their own home. At the same time, what does it do to today's young people to hear those kinds of excuses for long-ago behavior? Three high school students in Massachusetts walked out of class last week to express support for Dr. Christine Blasey Ford and other abuse survivors. It was a simple act, but in an age of social media quasi-activism, it got media attention, including ours. And so I'm happy to welcome activist Jack Torres, Somerville High School Class of 2020, to State of Belief Radio. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You and two male friends walked out of class last week. Tell me why.
We walked out because there was a lot of messaging going on, especially in the national media and by leadership in our government, saying that all high school guys have done this and this is just a normal thing about high school, which one is not. It's not a normal thing, especially what Brett Kavanaugh is alleged of doing. But more importantly, us high school boy students stand in solidarity with Christine Ford. We don't buy this rhetoric that it's okay because everyone's done it. First of all, not true. Second of all, even if everybody had done it, it still doesn't make it okay. So we just wanted to show that, you know, even us, as we've been slandered in the media, are standing in support of Dr. Christine Ford.
What was the response in your school and in your community?
There was a lot of support, especially among, you know, some of my immediate teachers and friends who, you know, shared similar views. And locally, we live in a pretty progressive city. And so the response was almost entirely positive. On social media, there were a lot of sort of trolls and a lot of like hate comments that we've been getting. But largely, it's been a very positive response.
How hard is it to be a young man, Jack, and to not assault women? Are you a ticking time bomb? Or is it actually possible for boys to be boys without being abusers?
Oh, my goodness. It is not hard at all. I think that the way that people talk about it as if it's just this inevitable thing that high schoolers are rapists is ridiculous. I think that, yes, our education system surrounding like sex and consent could be drastically improved. And I think that that's one important factor when looking at high school sexual assault is that consent isn't taught. And the teaching is always focused on the girl on how to say no. And the teaching never puts it on the guy. You know, people always blame the girl for the rape situation and nobody teaches the guys about, you know, what saying yes looks like versus saying no. And the fact that it's his responsibility to not be a predator. But in high school, they're making it sound like it's inevitable, and it's really not. You know, I know a lot of people who have never done anything like this. Unfortunately, yes, there is some of that rape culture, and it's very prevalent in high school scenarios, especially in party scenes. But most high schoolers do not partake in that.
So when you hear grown men use age as an excuse for something they did in their past, what does that make you feel?
I mean, it of course is rather belittling just to sort of pin it on age, because especially now with increased awareness because of social media and a lot of people are a lot more informed, high schoolers are becoming more and more responsible by the year in terms of our society. But also it just is not a valid excuse. They keep saying, well, he was in high school, or boys will be boys, or this is extremely common. And none of that is useful messaging, because it just says that just because it's prevalent, that makes it okay, which of course it's not. And even if it was as prevalent as they make it sound like it is, it would still be just as bad.
I know you're a prolific organizer. Is there more work you're planning on doing around respect for women in the months ahead?
One of the things that I would really love to do in the future is push for a bill or that would hopefully eventually become a law, starting in the Massachusetts legislature, but moving on towards federally, hopefully, that would mandate consent education in all high schools and all public high schools. I think that that's really important. I know in a lot of places, they're still a light year away from that, and still it's only abstinence, only education is being taught, which is clearly ineffective. But I think that if these GOP senators really believed that Kavanaugh and other high schoolers don't know the difference between rape and consensual intercourse, then they would support a consent ed bill. So hopefully some of the light that can come out of this is a reformed sex education system in this country.
Jack, I know your activism focuses on fighting gun violence. I want to give you some time to talk about that, because I know how important it is to you.
Yeah, totally. I sort of started with my own organizing, I guess. I'd like knocked on doors and stuff like that before, but never really organized anything until after the Parkland shooting. Me and a few friends at Somerville High School, Felix Brody, the one pictured, and many others organized walkouts at our school. And then helped organize the March for Our Lives in Boston with Vickiana Petitum, who's the executive director of March for Our Lives Boston, And then we moved on to doing 50 miles more Massachusetts, where we marched 50 miles to the Smith & Wesson headquarters. That was very powerful. And I think that a lot of these two issues are pretty intersectional. Both relate to violence, both relate to a lack of good education, both are affecting youth in a very powerful way. So I think that they're very connected issues, and hopefully I can work on both at the same time.
One last question. How old are you?
I am 16.
And I think that says it all. Jack Torres is a high school junior who is the lead organizer of 50 Miles More Massachusetts and political strategist at March for Our Lives Boston. In support of Christine Blasey Ford, he and two classmates walked out of school last week and succeeded in getting us thinking about young men who do not assault and then silence women. Jack, in your articulate Twitter feed, one tweet stood out for me that is so simple, but so powerful, that I want to ask you to read it out loud as we finish this conversation. Would you do that for us now, please?
My tweet read, "Please vote, I can't. Please."
Jack Torres, thank you so much for what you're doing and for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your generous contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, as my friend Welton says, you all take care of each other. I'm Jack Moline for Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.